Welcome back to another edition of the Sound Singer podcast. I'm super excited for today's episode, but before we get started, I just wanted to let you know that fall is just right around the corner. And with fall comes this energy of signing up for new and exciting courses or one-to-one training. And I wanted to let you know about some of my offerings. First of all, my vocal studio's name is Alita Vocal Studio, and I've been working with singers and voice users from all levels and contemporary styles for the last 14 years. My experience and education has given me the tools to equip my clients with specialized training and support as they move forward in their vocal goals. Whether you are a budding beginner or a seasoned vocal athlete, optimized training can offer you the right tools to set you up for success and more vocal confidence. I offer one-to-one training as well as self-study courses. As we head into fall, I've opened up some new slots for one-to-one training and coaching. If you're interested, fill out a coaching application form on my website. My website is alidavocalstudio.com. That's A-L-I-D-A vocalstudio.com. If you've got questions, you can send me an email right on my website and we can chat. On another note, it's been almost a year since I started this podcast, and I gotta say, I've enjoyed it immensely. The expert guests, the feedback that I've gotten has all been amazing. If you want to see more episodes and specific topics, please send me a DM on Instagram or an email. My Instagram is at Alita Vocal Studio. If you've enjoyed this podcast so far, please leave a 5-star review. This helps the podcast so much. Okay, so now back to our regular scheduled programming. Have you ever heard the phrase, your body is your instrument? How we take care of ourselves is ultimately going to determine how well our voice functions. Part of taking care of our health and well-being is addressing how we nourish ourselves. And this can be a very controversial topic and tends to open up a huge can of worms. But I do feel we need a voice of reason. Voice teachers get asked a lot of questions about nutrition, and we are very often the first point of contact for people when it comes to vocal health. What should I eat before performing? What should I avoid? There are a lot of myths out there around nutrition. And so we're going to get to the bottom of it today by consulting with an expert. We're here to cut out the nonsense and shame surrounding food and educate ourselves on the importance of nourishing ourselves adequately. My guest today is Duncan Rock. Duncan is a healthcare practitioner and opera singer. As a singer, he has spent over a decade singing roles at some of the world's leading opera houses. As a healthcare practitioner, he holds a master's degree in both physiotherapy and nutritional science. He is the leading expert on nutrition for singers and professional voice users. With his background in the performing arts, fitness, and nutrition, he's going to help us discover the perfect harmony between vocal performance and overall well-being. His platform is called the Vocal Pro Health Hub, and it specializes in providing the latest nutritional and vocal health information. Duncan, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you. It's nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
It's been a while since we last chatted. I think we spoke around the time of the pandemic on our Instagram lives. And I was excited to chat with you then because I, as a voice teacher, have had so many questions over the years with regards to nutrition and a lot of myths around nutrition. And, you know, I've encountered quite a few performers that want more information. And so I can't think of a better expert to chat with. How did you get started on your journey as both a singer and now a nutritionist and physiotherapist?
Yeah, it's now that I'm almost 40, the story gets increasingly convoluted and complex, but I'll try to keep it brief. So as in terms of like anything related to health, so I think physiotherapy and nutrition are sort of extensions of that world. That's just a love affair I've had with health, fitness, sport, culture, all that. Since I was a teenager growing up in Australia, you know, a very sort of sporty, outdoorsy culture. As a singer, it really wasn't in my life for a long, long time. But you know, I always knew I could sing. You know how some people know they can dance or not? Like, I know I can't dance, but I know I can. I always knew I could sing. You know, there's everyone, you sort of sing a little song, people go, oh, you've got a nice voice sort of thing. But in terms of this 10 plus years of being an opera singer, it's almost came out of the blue a little bit. When I was studying at university, I started sort of taking music units at a place called the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, sort of out of interest, because, you know, I was a little bit lost. I wasn't really sure what I was doing with my life as a sort of 19, 20 year old. And it seemed like fun. And then from there, it sort of snowballed. I was very lucky to win a very small singing competition. It felt huge at the time, but, you know, retrospectively, it was obviously tiny. But that, one of the judges on the panel of that competition was one of the artistic directors at the West Australian Opera, which is a small company in West Australia, where I grew up in Perth. And they said, come to the opera house and sing for us. And I was like, sure, I'll come sing. That'll be fun. And so I went and I sang for the artistic director and the sort of, I guess, the casting director. I don't know what their official roles were. And they said, you know, you could be an opera singer if you wanted. And I kind of thought, I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what that means. And, you know, they sort of explained, they said, oh, you know, it means you'd have to probably go to the States or to Europe and study. And then you basically travel around the world singing, you know, if you do well, you travel around the world singing roles at opera houses. And it sounded like a lot of fun. So they put me forward for a big competition called the Australian Singing Competition, the Marty Award, which takes place in Sydney. And I won. Oh my gosh, that was back in 2006. And that was insanely generous scholarship I won. I basically won a free ride to come to London. Everything was paid for, my rent, my flights, my tuition. I mean, a scholarship worth in excess of $70,000, Australian dollars, huge, really generous. And that started that journey for me. I came to London, studied at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama for a couple of years. And then I started singing roles in the UK at English National, Glyndebourne, then started doing a bit of travel. And now here we are, gosh, more than 10 years later.
It takes such discipline to study the art form of opera and years of study because you have to be specialized in those languages, right?
Yes, I will admit a huge weakness of mine has always been languages. I never did it as a kid. You know, in Australia, certainly when I was growing up, there wasn't much impetus to learn second languages. Like they, you know, if you meet someone from Sweden, they speak four languages fluently, but they actually speak seven and they're just humble about it. You know, it's certainly not part of the culture. But yes, I mean, I certainly sang a lot, particularly in Italian. Obviously, the role of Don Giovanni, the Mozart, I sang the most. You have to have pretty good Italian for that. La Bohème, things like that. But yes, there is a certain amount of discipline needed to and focus to develop as a complete opera singer. You know, not just your voice, but your performance instincts, your acting, your languages. You know.
So all of that travel brought you to an understanding of how to look after your vocal health. And did that lead you into the world of nutrition?
Yes. So after about 8 years of jumping from here to there to everywhere, I loved it. I don't want to sound ungrateful for it, but I started to think about the future. You know, when I, you know, it's all fun and games when you're sort of 28 and jumping from Madrid to New York. But it was 2018, I remember distinctly, because I was working in Australia. And my then girlfriend, now wife, and I had just become engaged or were about to get engaged. I can't exactly remember. And we were talking about having children. And that year, I think I was at my home for 4 months of the year. I was traveling more than half the year. I was traveling 7-8 months of the year. I was in New York. I was in Madrid. I was in Australia. I was kind of everywhere. And it was wonderful and I was enjoying it. But knowing myself, my instincts kicked in and I thought, I'm not going to want to do this when I'm a dad. So I, you know, I thought about it a lot. I mean, this wasn't a slow process. This wasn't a quick process. It was a very slow process. And I started to look for things I could potentially do, because I wouldn't describe myself as particularly ambitious, but I'm very curious. I like to be busy. I like to be doing things. I like to be learning. You know, I have 4 master's degrees for a reason. You know, I just kind of like studying and learning. And I started looking for things that I could possibly do that would mean I could do less singing, because it means I could travel less. And I thought, at the time, I thought, well, maybe I could sing half as much as I am now. So instead of being away 8 months of the year, I'm away 4 months of the year. That's still quite a lot, but it's a lot less, you know. But then I could maybe do some other work. And it sort of just dawned upon me, because I realized, I remember I was walking to the gym, and I realized I was listening to like my 7th podcast that week about nutrition, because I found it fascinating. And it just kind of dawned on me, well, why don't I study this and actually learn it properly, rather than just learning it sort of ad hoc secondhand by reading books and listening to podcasts and listen, you know, I could just study it. I could study it officially. And so I found a course that I was able to do, a master's degree in nutritional science, that I was able to do somewhat remotely, because I still had lots of travel. And that was the beginning of that, that sort of leg of things. And I completed the master's degree and I started working with people. And then I started working at the Voice Care Centre in London, which is a centre that specifically deals with singers and vocal performers who are experiencing some sort of health issue that is impacting their ability to work as a singer or vocal performer. And that it sort of has snowballed from there.
So what are the 4 master's degrees that you have?
It sounds like the worst humble brag. I'm not entirely proud of having 4 master's degrees, because it sort of shows the skittishness of my life, of my brain, as much as it shows, I don't know, I guess it's certain capacity for study. But so I have 2 in music, obviously. I have 1 in master's in music. Yeah. And I also have a master's in performance, which is a slightly different, like more performance focused master's degree, which is like the opera school part of my training. Mm-hmm. And I have a master's in nutritional science. And now, most recently, which actually is now the biggest focus of my life, which is a master's in physiotherapy, which in America, in North America, I think you call this a physical therapist, but it's the same thing.
What do you think is the most common obstacle that performers face when it comes to nutrition or even physical therapy?
I think in terms of nutrition, unfortunately, at the moment, the if I could give an umbrella to what the most common problem is, it's misinformation. We have information overload. It's unless you know how to sift through nonsense, you can be lost. It can seem so complicated because if you go to, let's say, just social media or even just the internet for your information, you can have one person saying, if you eat any meat, for example, it's toxic and poisonous and you're going to die poor and lonely. And that person's a medical doctor. And then you have another medical doctor saying, actually, what we should be eating is only beef and you should be a carnivore, like a lion or something. And you know how you've got 2 people telling you the opposite thing. And they're both, you know, if it's social media, everyone has to sort of sell themselves. They're both like, you know, former athletes with ripped abs and can lift a car over their head. And you're like, how am I supposed to know what to do? I've got 2 people, equally impressive, equally qualified, telling me to do the opposite thing. How do I sift through this information? So it's not that one specific concern comes up. It's just people don't know. People are confused. People are just generally confused.
Yeah, and rightfully so. I was just going to ask you, like, where do you think we're at in today's world when it comes to this?
To be honest, like, I love working as a nutritionist. It's wonderful. And I think it's extremely valuable.
Yeah.
However, if I'm honest, one of the reasons I have now shifted more into physiotherapy, well, there are lots of reasons, but one of them is, but I'm making this number up. In the majority of cases, let's say 90% as a ballpark figure, nutrition is painfully simple. I mean, painfully simple. But I believe a culture of overcomplication has arisen around it because that's the way you can make money off it. When I was studying at university, they did a study at my university. I wasn't involved in it, but where they, I won't say the magazine, but let's say they were looking at a certain men's health magazine, a magazine that dealt in men's health. And we did a study on it. And what we realized is in January, they would say 10 reasons why you should be eating more meat. And in February, they'd write an article saying 10 reasons why you should be eating less meat. You know, there's money to be made in confusing people because they need to then keep buying your book. And as with, this is a bigger issue than I'm qualified to deal with, but as our information space becomes global and becomes increasingly on social media, increasingly polarized, what happens is the people who tell you to eat, you know, fully vegan diet, all you can eat is fruit that, and you're not even allowed to pick it off the tree. That's bad. You have to drop it in front of you and you only need to, they get a lot of attention because it's interesting. It's extreme. Or the people who say you're only allowed to eat beef or you're only allowed to eat elk meat. They get a lot of attention too because it's extreme, you know. Our information space filters for the extreme opinions. So the people who are actually giving you the good, boring advice, like, yeah, you know, eat a nice balance of vegetables, fruits, carbohydrates, and some lean meats. They don't get any attention because it's not sellable. It's not Instagrammable. And I think that's the space we're in. I think actually most people, their instinct is correct when it comes to food, but they get thrown around by, oh, but this doctor who just, you know, swam the English Channel in a record time tells me I need to eat this weird diet. You know, it's unfortunate, I think, actually. I think it's a shame.
Yeah. Well, I can only hope that with new information that we'll start to get back to basic. Do you think singers and professional voice users and performers might sometimes undernourish themselves?
Yes. Yes is the short answer, but I will elaborate if you would like.
Yes.
So to undernourish is a really interesting concept in a modern context, because actually a huge problem we now have in what we call the developed world or the Western world, however people like to describe it, is what we call the malnutrition of obesity. So we have a situation where a huge proportion of the population is over consuming calories, but under consuming nutrients. So I think typically we think of undernourished as people who just don't eat enough food generally, which of course is a problem. And obviously that, you know, I'm not hugely qualified to deal with eating disorders on that end of the spectrum. I sometimes work with people at the sort of tail end of their treatment. And that's about where my scope of practice ends. I'm not an expert in that field. But look, to see someone who, you know, the typical patient in that situation might be like an 18 or 19 year old, normally female, but sometimes male, young performer, normally dance-based, who just, you know, some horrible teacher told them they were too fat. And because they were, do you deal in pounds or kilos?
Usually pounds.
Because yeah. They were, yeah, 120 pounds. You know, it's appalling. I mean, you know, we don't have to talk about this. It's appalling. You know, there's no conversation. There's no argument. And to see the detriment that can do to someone is just horrendous. It can be really shocking, actually. However, on a population level, that's a huge problem on an individual level. It's not a huge problem on a population level. You know, there's not a huge amount of people who are fit into that category when you look at a whole population. What we experience at a population level is the malnutrition of obesity. So many of us are just eating because of the proliferation of calorie-dense, nutrient-poor processed foods just becoming ubiquitous in our eating culture. Tons of us are sort of overfed but malnourished. And it causes huge detriment, huge health detriment. So yeah, when I talk about being nourished, I really talk about giving your body everything it needs, but not more. And that's, there's two halves of the picture there that need to be considered. It can be hard, particularly if you're, you know, traveling, particularly if you're jumping from country to country to country, particularly if you're, you know, if you've got weird hours, you know, if it's, you know, midnight and you've just done a huge performance and you want to eat some nourishing food, where can you go to get it? You know, if you're out, for example, it can be really difficult. And it seems to be increasingly difficult to do that.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about meal timing and nourishing ourselves for performance, because I think that's a huge thing. I get asked that a lot. Common sense would tell me that, you know, having a meal a couple hours before you have to perform will help you fuel for that performance. Am I on to something there?
Yeah, it sounds good to me. I mean, look, people need to find their individual variants, what specifically works for them. But as a general rule, yeah, I mean, you want to be finishing the meal, I mean, at least 90 minutes before a performance, but probably more like two hours is probably ideal. So if curtain up is 7:30, it's a slightly weird time to eat, but you definitely want to be finished eating by about 5:30, 6 o'clock. Because, you know, digestion is, you know, takes energy from the body. Digestion uses your blood, it uses your facility, and you don't want that, you know, you don't want that heaviness. But a nice meal containing a nice mix of complex carbohydrates, some protein, some fats for satiety, some of this enjoyable would be nice as well. That sort of thing. Once again, it doesn't have to be particularly complex. You know, if I said, should you eat 4 McDonald's cheeseburgers an hour before a performance, what would your instinct say? It's probably not the best idea. You know, if I said, you know, you should eat some, I don't know, chicken and potatoes and broccoli 2 hours and before, you know, generally people's common sense in this regard, unless they've been massively misled, is normally fairly accurate.
Can you talk a little bit more about what should be on our plate, or should, not should, but what can be on our plate to help us have that energy, to help us have that fuel to perform optimally?
Yeah, I love your self-correction, you know, because, you know, everything in this space is a suggestion, not a mandate. You know, I'm giving advice from that I've distilled from obviously studying this stuff, reading research, but also, you know, filtering in experience of my own, experience of other, but I never, you know, people can take it or leave it. It's never a mandate. So look, generally speaking, you know, if one looks down at their plate, a quote unquote healthy plate, about a third of the plate should be some sort of complex carbohydrate, rice, white or brown, no problem. Potato, sweet potato, normal potato, no problem. Pasta, wholemeal pasta, normal pasta, it's fine. You know, we don't have to demonize it. Yes, should you eat big bowls of pasta every night? Probably not for a lifetime. It'll probably add up, but it's fine. You know, unless you have a gluten intolerance, you're fine.
I'll make sure that my Italian dad knows that you said that. He'll be very happy to hear that.
And, you know, I would never dream of trying to tell an Italian they can't eat pasta. I that right hook would knock me out, I'm sure. You know, and then, or you can get fancy. Look, there is some evidence that things like couscous, quinoa is maybe a little bit better for you, but I wouldn't stress out about it. You know, that's the details. Some sort of complex carbohydrates. Why? Energy. Carbohydrate is the preferred fuel source of the brain, most importantly. But also it's a preferred fuel source for anything above a moderate physical activity in terms of strenuous. So, you know, if you are doing anything slightly more physically strenuous, your carbohydrate is the preferred fuel source. Also fiber. Carbohydrates have fiber in them, which is, the more we study it, the more we know it's vital importance to human health, digestive health, cardiovascular health. Then about another third of the plate, third to 50%, should be vegetables. You know, It should be, you know, the stuff that people think is boring, but if you learn how to cook a little bit, can be absolutely delicious. Broccoli, peas, Brussels sprouts, spinach, romaine lettuce, carrots, you know, all that good stuff. Why? I mean, all the stuff that your grandma told you should eat, your grandma was right. Micronutrients. These will give you all the little things that we don't think about that make our body run optimally. Zinc, potassium, vitamin C, vitamin K, folate. This is, you know, this is where you get them. The other reason is satiety. These foods are the opposite of processed foods. They are nutrient dense and very low in calories. You know, calorie per volume is you know, off the charts, you know, good in that. You can eat, you know, how much broccoli can you eat and until you're like, get that broccoli away from me? You know, you'll never overeat it. You'll never overeat calories on these foods, with a few exceptions. Maybe avocados you could eat. You know, they're more calorie dense, but you know, who can afford to overeat avocados these days?
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's that. And then the other third, some sort of protein source. The fundamental nutrient, you know, you can live pretty well, you know, obviously protein normally comes with fat in it as well, obviously if you're eating any animal product, but you know, it's the fundamental nutrient. You need it for functioning of all body systems. It's not just for building big biceps. You know, I know people think protein, they think protein powder, they think bodybuilders. That's a tiny proportion of the body's protein needs. I'm not a vegan myself. I do have clients, patients who are, and that's fine. So if you are a non-meat eater, seitan, tofu, chickpeas, red, you know, lentils, all the legumes, beans, all that kind of stuff, great. If you are a vegan that you don't want to be optimally healthy, there are some extra considerations, which we can talk about if you're interested. Or if you're not, if you eat animal products, some sort of like, I would say, moderately lean to lean protein. I mean, fatty proteins are fine too, but if you're constantly eating like pork belly, your potential to overconsume calories goes way up. Like some meats are just really, really calorie dense, unnecessarily so. You know, for the amount of protein you get, you're getting just tons and tons of calories. So, you know, chicken thighs, chicken breast. Red meat in moderation is absolutely fine. A steak, salmon, you know, fish, prawns, all that kind of stuff. You know, the proportions, it doesn't have to be like exactly, you don't have to get out a ruler and measure a third of your plate, but that is a healthy plate of food in about those proportions. You can't go wrong. I mean, if you did that every meal for your entire life, you'd be doing wonderfully.
I love that. And there's no room for food shame. Just, you know, understanding those macro and micronutrients and once in a while going through the McDonald's drive-through if need be.
Yeah.
It'd be fun. But, you know, on an average day, I really try my best to try to get my macros in. On my Instagram stories, I ask my audience, what are some myths that you've encountered or what are some questions that you might have? And I've gotten a few questions in and I thought I'd just take some time to ask you. So number one, consuming spicy foods or sparkling drinks, does that cause acid reflux?
This is such a great question. And actually, I'm going to start with a shameless plug, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
I have just started a YouTube channel, which is somewhat attached to my Instagram,
yep,
called the Vocal Pro Health Hub. And what I'm using that for is to compile answers to all of these questions that I get asked regularly. I'm sort of, I want it to be a database of every question that I get asked more than once, basically. You know, how should I hydrate? Is caffeine bad for my voice? Is dairy bad for my voice? Is having a visible six pack bad for my voice? Is eating spicy food going to give me reflux? All the questions I get asked a lot. I'm compiling a database of complete video style answers to these questions. So I would love, if anyone is interested in this sort of information, have a visit, see if I've already answered your question, or If I haven't, write me a little message on one of the videos, a little comment, and I'll make the video for you. If you have a particular question you'd like answered. So for this particular question, which I am in the process of answering in a video, I've just written the script for it, actually. So basically, the answer, unfortunately, is maybe. If you'd asked me a year and a half ago, I would have said probably not. However, there has been a bit of research that has come out since then that gives a little bit more evidence to the possibility that, generally speaking, spicy foods and carbonated drinks might be a general exacerbator of reflux symptoms. So generally speaking, for reflux symptoms, the two main culprits, and everyone hates to hear this, but I'll be the bearer of bad news. The two main culprits are sugar and alcohol. These are the ones that we know when we study enough people, they tend to exacerbate symptoms in enough people that we say these are good things to generally avoid. The problem with reflux is inter-individual variability. What exacerbates symptoms in me might alleviate symptoms in you. There's huge variance. So finding consistent threads can be difficult. However, sugar is one, extrinsic sugars. I'm not talking about an apple or a banana. And alcohol. After that, eating behaviors are consistent factors. So for someone who experiences reflux, eating behaviors such as maybe consuming smaller, but perhaps more frequent meals may be beneficial. Also, your posture when you eat, and particularly the posture you retain after you eat, directly after you eat, may be quite significant. So after you've sat and enjoyed your meal, don't go straight to lying down and like watching television or something like that. Also, one that people often roll their eyes at me for, but I promise the evidence is quite strong. Lying on your left side is good for reflux. So the esophagus actually attaches into the right side of the stomach, not directly into the middle. So if you imagine with simple gravity, if you lie on your left side, the contents of your stomach will go away from the esophagus, which is on the right side. So it seems crude, it seems very mechanical, but sometimes our bodies are very crude and mechanical. They're, you know, obviously they're infinitely complex, but they're also sacks of meat, essentially. So you lie on your left side, the stomach contents moves to the left side away from the esophagus and is less likely to reflux up the esophagus. The same effect as if you slightly elevate your head and upper torso a few inches. You know, by simple gravity, the contents of the stomach, they need to fight gravity to reflux up the esophagus. Things like this sound crude, sound strange, but they work. And the final one, which I would say is strong evidence. So you've got sugar, alcohol, eating behaviors. And the final one with there's strong evidence for, unfortunately, central adiposity. Central adiposity is the fat that we store in our midsection. So it tends to be more of a problem for middle-aged men like me rather than, you know, young women or something who, you know, tend to store fat in different areas of the body. So it's not so much to do with total body weight. This has been seen independent of what we call BMI, body mass index. It's about where you store the fat in the body. So if you're someone who happens to store a lot of fat around the midsection, around the stomach, around the organs there, that is, seems to be directly correlated with reflux. So much so that if you map complaints of reflux against increases in central adiposity, they almost map against each other like a line. So that's another one. So the more we store fat in our midsection through our lifestyle choices, the more we get reflux. That's fairly conclusive at this point. Then, to specifically answer the question, yes, some moderate evidence stuff like carbonated drinks, spicy food, for some people, caffeine, citrusy style foods. There seems to be a little bit of evidence of this coming up now, although some of it is, you know, just hand-me-down information, you know, what they used to call old wives' tales. Now, there's a little bit of evidence for some of this stuff, and I will highlight this specifically in this video I'm creating. So to say that spicy food and carbonated drinks will exacerbate reflux isn't accurate, but they may be potential exacerbators for some people.
Very, very cool. And I'll put a link to that video in the show notes. And my Instagram live with you, we talked about dairy in the voice. That's a very common misconception. But maybe you could just chat very quickly about, does dairy affect the voice?
Milk and dairy products do not create mucus. This seems to be the main complaint. People think that they will create mucus in their throat. This is a complete misnomer. There's not even a sort of theoretical reason why this would be the case. Dairy doesn't create mucus in the throat or anywhere else in the body. Milk dairy products are what we call an emulsion, which is fat droplets suspended in a liquid. So emulsions have a certain stickiness, a certain viscosity to them. To illustrate this, it's very simple. If you take a glass of water, tilt it to the side and tilt it back, you wouldn't have much residue of the water on the glass remaining. If you do the same glass full of milk, tilt it to the side, tilt it back, you see the milk residue because of the emulsion. It's a certain viscosity. This can, for some singers, voice professionals, leave a temporary sense of stickiness, heaviness, viscosity, glugginess in the throat. It's important to recognize that this will go away with the passing of time, or if you need it to go away quickly, it'll likely go away with a glass of water. It doesn't create mucus, but it can leave this sort of slight stickiness in the throat. However, and here's the really important part, direct investigation into this has shown that people who complain about that sensation when they drink dairy milk also notice that same sensation when they drink milk alternatives, soy milk, oat milk, all that kind of stuff. What I notice is that people, they'll say, well, I'll have a soy milk latte because I need to sing later. But the evidence suggests that you're going to have the same experience on that or any other sort of emulsion style drink. So, you know, with this one, I always think, you know, people say, well, so what? Why do you care? And I'm not trying to sell you a cow. But I just think free yourself from the shackles of this myth. You know, you don't have to worry about it. If you get this feeling, just, you know, if you switch from dairy to soy because you're someone who experiences this feeling, you're not necessarily doing anything substantively beneficial for your vocal health.
Wow. Did you all hear that? You can have a regular milk latte if you want, unless you have a dairy allergy, right?
Yeah. Lactose intolerance is a thing, which is an intolerance to lactose, which is the sugar you find in milk. It's genetically determined. It affects certain populations in much higher rates than others. Southern Asian or Southeast Asian populations tend to suffer from it the most. But that's the symptoms of that are gastric. They are flatulence, all that fun stuff. Which I guess, you know, you don't want to be on stage with gastric issues, you know.
Absolutely. Wow. Okay. One other myth, and then we'll get on to hydration. So honey lemon tea. I know you did a video about this, so I will link that video in the show notes. But if you could just say real quick, the myth of honey lemon tea, when we as singers are like, oh, I should have some honey lemon tea to soothe my throat. Is there any truth to that?
Look, there's nothing wrong with honey lemon tea. If you find it comforting, if you find it, you know, great, enjoy it. There's no detriment, but is there like strong evidence to suggest that it's good for the voice? No. That certain honeys have a certain antimicrobial properties that may theoretically be beneficial. Obviously, you've got vitamin C in lemon, which, you know, if you're vitamin C deficient, that can be good for your immune system. You know, heat, you know, you get a bit of steam if it's hot enough, that can be. But no, this is a hand-me-down piece of information. Enjoy it if you like, but it's not going to compensate for poor vocal hygiene in the rest of your life.
Can you tell us what adequate hydration would look like for the average singer or voice user?
Yeah, it's really simple. There are more accurate calculations if you know more evidence about yourself, but this one is good enough. 30 to 40 mils, sorry to use, I don't know if you use mils in Canada, 30 to 40 mils of fluid, let's say water, per kilogram of body weight per day. So just for easy maths, for those of you who are like doing mental arithmetic, I use my maths because I weigh about 100 kilos. So the math is super easy. I weigh 100 kilos. So 30 to 40 mils per day would be 3 to 4 liters of water per day. I know it sounds a lot. We're not talking about surviving here. We're talking about optimization. Yep. And if you want to optimize your hydration status, that's about the amount you need. And I would go for the higher end. I drink 4 liters of water per day. And I think it's the easiest thing. I always say to clients, to patients, look, this is the lowest hanging fruit. If you're not willing to do this, you know, I never send anyone away because I want to help people. But I do, you know, a bit of tough love. I say, look, if you're not willing to do this, we're probably not going to get where you want to be. This is the easiest thing to do. Just drink more water. It's free. You just got to remember to do it. One thing I will add to hydration, which is new-ish. I think in any type of performance situation where you might be exerting yourself a bit, and particularly if you're sweating. So when I say performance, it could be athletic performance, but also a performance where you might be, I don't know, running around stage, wearing a costume. Certainly, I don't know if you're in a rock band or something, or, you know, pop star. Gosh, I mean, how much does Taylor Swift sweating? Maybe she doesn't sweat because she's so perfect, but the amount of running around she does and jumping and dancing and Beyonce, come on, she must sweat on stage, right?
It's like a marathon out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing what they do, right? You know, for me, you know, doing a performance of Don Giovanni wearing big, heavy period costumes, sweat, you know.
Yep.
I would recommend and I can give you the equation for it, a particular, it's almost like super hydrating formula, which is what they recommend for like certain athletic performance. It's really simple. What you want is a solution, let's say per liter of fluid, because it's the easiest maths. Yeah. In that, you want some sort of electrolyte drink. And to be honest, basically any electrolyte formula you buy will probably be fine. You can buy it in sachets, you can buy a big tub, scoop, you can buy little effervescent capsules. They're all good. They're all the same, basically. Pop one of those in there for your sodium, chloride, magnesium, the stuff you sweat out, potassium. And then also in there, you want about 3 grams of carbohydrate per 100 mils. So if you have 1 liter, you want about 30 grams of carbohydrate in there. So it's a little, the drink depends on what your taste palate is, but it'll taste like a little bit sweet, but nothing like an orange juice or a can of Coke or anything like that. You know, yeah. This is the formula that, you know, sports scientists have worked out is the optimal, it will give you sort of the optimal hydration intake. It's the fastest absorbed type of drink. So, you know, this is something I would use for myself. I just did run a performances of an opera called The Rape of Lucretia in France, in Toulouse. And it was quite an active show and I was wearing a big costume and, you know, sweat. So I would drink this during the performance. This is what I personally use when I train mixed martial arts because it's very hot, very sweaty. And I want to go for like an hour, 2 hours. If you really want to optimize hydration during an event, that's the way to do it.
Very cool. So not just like electrolytes, but adding that 30 grams of carb. What exactly is that?
I use dextrose, which is what, you know, marathon runners and stuff will use. It's, you can buy it in a big bag. I just bought a 2 kilo bag. It was 8 pounds or something like, like $12. It's cheap. That'll last me months. But if you wanted, you could literally just put sugar in there and shake it up, or you could squirt some honey in there, whatever, you know. But yeah, the easiest is just with like some sort of carbohydrate powder. They're so cheap. There's no unlikely to be a sort of cost barrier to entry there.
Well, this has been so helpful, and I hope to have you back on. Duncan, can you tell us where people can find you and your videos?
Sure. So for the vocal health realm of things, I have the Vocal Pro Health Hub is my Instagram account. And I link all of my YouTube videos to the account. So the YouTube is also the Vocal Pro Health Hub. And if you just type that into YouTube, you'll find my channel. And I have all that. It's a relatively recent project, but I'm gradually, I hope to do sort of a video a week. And I hope to just amass a library of answers to all of these questions. Because I feel some of it is so basic. I'd rather just raise the floor of people's general knowledge in this realm. And I think this is just the easiest way for me to do it. Because I do find I'm very happy to do it, but I do find I often answer the same questions for many people. So I thought, well, if I make a video, it can get to like hundreds of people or whatever amount of people. So the Vocal Pro Health Hub. And if you have any questions, please just, if you're watching one of the videos, just write a comment and I'll make sure I see it. And people have been doing this and I am compiling a list of, okay, I need to get to this. I need to get to this. I need to get to this. And just as a side thing, I know it's not so on topic, but I did mention actually my day job, what I spend most of my time doing now is working as a physiotherapist at a spinal clinic for people with back pain. That's really my passion at the moment because I'm a lifelong sufferer of back pain. It really messed my life up at one point. And I'm doing the same for that. And I realize it's not so performance specific, but you know, about 50% of people at some point in their life suffer from pretty tremendous back pain. So, and that includes singers and performers too. So the same I'm doing with Vocal Pro Health Hub, I have also a YouTube channel called The Back Pain Guide. And I'm doing the same thing. Any question that a patient asks me more than once, I log it, I write it down, and I make a video to answer that. If it can be answered sort of generally, I do the same. You know, should I use a sitting, standing desk? Should I use heat or ice for my back pain? You know, should I lie on the back, on the floor when my back is sore? Is swimming good for my back? Is yoga good for my back? That sort of thing. I'm doing the same thing for sufferers of back pain.
Very helpful. Duncan, thank you so much again. I hope to have you back on and have yourself a good rest of your day. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Nice to see you.